Okay, let me start. Good morning, and this is for me the last lecture, not for you, so every good thing has to come to an end. But today I shall try to make a short resume of all what I should have discussed in this lecture, but we definitely had no time or no wishes. So I will discuss a few aspects of gauge theories, insisting on the physical question about gauge theories, because up to now, during this week, we have discussed mostly important, but technical, if you want, or rather than technical, you know, fundamental aspects of the quantum, the quantum formalism applied to non-abelian gauge theories. But of course, we have to go back to the physics, because they have been introduced and they are needed in order to describe the strong and electroweak interactions. So I want first to say a few words about renormalization. And so we have seen how to construct a consistent framework to do perturbation theory in non-abelian gauge theories and describing also their coupling with matter fields. But of course, we expect that, and it does indeed, there are problems associated with renormalization of non-abelian gauge theories as well as abelian gauge theories, simply because as for the scalar field theories or series with fermions that we have been discussing in the first 2 weeks, the coupling constant of non-abelian gauge theories is dimensionless. So if you think about, remember, basically the action is something like minus 1 over 4 g squared integral d 4x trace of f mu nu, where basically f mu nu contains d mu is d mu a nu minus d nu a mu plus or minus, I don't remember, a mu a nu. And you see, now, if you go back to dimensional analysis, you see that in order for this to be dimensionally consistent, remember, d mu as a dimension of, let us say, a length to the power minus 1. Of course, it's a derivative with respect to a space coordinate. Therefore, for this to be consistent, A mu must have the dimension of a length minus 1, or if you prefer, of a mass to the power. Remember, mass is energy, is momentum, and is the inverse of a length, C equal 1 everywhere. And therefore, this has a dimension 4 in terms of mass. This has dimension minus 4. We are in 4 dimensions. So the dimension of the coupling constant G is 0. It's just a pure number for any non-abelian gauge series. And it's already true for the alpha constant, the structure constant in QED. Okay. So the coupling constant is dimensionless. Which has two important properties. The first property is that as for the massless phi to the 4, the classical theory will be scale invariant. And now, in most cases, the quantum theory is expected to have a scale anomaly. There are some cases, some very specific case, where some gauge theories have no scale anomaly. are very, very interesting theory, which are very much studied now because they are related to the ADS-CFT correspondence and two-string theory. But essentially, those are n equal 4 supersymmetric Young-Mills theory. Okay, so accept if you want, accept some. Okay, so you must have a lot of symmetries in order to have a theory with no ultraviolet divergence. Okay, so to show this, in fact, one has, of course, to see, to start to study perturbation theory, to see whether there are ultraviolet divergences, and they do have ultraviolet divergences, and see whether they can be renormalized or not, and what are the properties of the resulting renormalized consistent quantum theory. So I will discuss this. Let me discuss this just in the case of the U1 gauge theory, namely QED. That's the simplest case. So QED, remember, the action is, well, in addition to these terms, you have, of course, the action. You have a psi I d slash plus a slash minus m psi. This is the action for the Dirac field, the coupling to the of the electron and the positron to the electromagnetic field, to the photon. Then you have this 1 over 4 e squared. Here the coupling constant is, of course, just it's just the charge of the electron. In QED, this term disappears because it's an abelian gauge field. You have only one component of F. And you have, in addition, the gauge fixion term that I wrote. See, this is a gauge fixing. And remember, for a UN gauge field, there is somewhere in the theory a ghost field you have to introduce, but the ghost field is not coupled to the electromagnetic field because the coupling is proportional to the structure constant, which disappears. So no coupling between the gauge, the ghosts, and the photons, so you can forget about the ghosts. And therefore, then you can look at what are the divergent diagrams of the theory. So someone asked me last time, oh, but in general, in gauge theory, you have diagrams like that. You have some kind of tadpole diagrams where you have a photon of a gauge field which creates a pair of fermions and antifermions. Or also, you can have also something like that with a ghost. And this is a one particle irreducible diagram which appears in the theory. Of course, the fact is that because of some symmetries, simple symmetries, you can check that those diagrams are always zero, and that's essentially the parity symmetry of the theory. You have here, you have to integrate over a momentum an integral which is odd in the momentum, because remember the propagator for the photon is 1 over, for the, here the propagator is 1 over p slash minus m. So in some sense it's odd. And of course you have you also have a gamma mu here. And so you have, for instance, for the, you have a trace of gamma mu, which is 0, some gamma matrices for the fermion. And for the, for the ghost field, you have an integral of d4p. The propagator of the ghost is p squared, but you have a coupling which is in p. You have a p, yes, so which is even. So in both cases, those diagrams are zero. So what remains are the diagrams we know, and there are three diagrams. There are three kinds of diagrams. First, there is a diagrams. There is a one loop. So let us look at the one loop diagrams of QED. Yes? No, no, no. But if there were ghosts, this is a general argument. The fact that those one particle diagrams are not present comes from, is true in any gauge series coupled to any fermions. Yes, okay. So then you have those, in QED, you have those three diagrams. You have the diagrams which comes out in the propagator of the fermion. You have these diagrams which comes in the calculation of the propagator of the gauge field, and you have the diagrams, a famous diagram like that, which comes at first order when you look at the three vertex function, namely the diagrams which describes the interaction between the photon and the electron. Okay, so these diagrams are the three diagrams which comes out in, when you compute the radiative correction of the propagator of the electron, the propagator of the photon, and the vertex, so the interaction. And if you make some counting, you see that, remember, the propagator for the electron is something like 1 over p slash plus or minus m, with a factor I, but let me not take care of the factor I. So it behaves like 1 over a momentum at large momenta. The propagator of the photon, this is the propagator for the electron. The propagator for the photon behave like 1 over p squared. There are some g mu nu, there is a gauge fixing time, but the propagator of the photon behaves like 1 over p squared. Okay. So you see that potentially a diagram like that has a dangerous divergence, which is linear, because you have a d4p. Let me show this later on. So here I have drawn the diagrams. This diagram has a potential, this diagram has a potential lambda divergence if lambda is the ultraviolet cutoff. This diagram you have 1 over p, 1 over p, you integrate over 4, so it has a potential lambda squared divergence. And this diagram, by the same argument, has only, so let me rewrite these diagrams like that. Here you have a 1 over p, 1 over p, 1 over p squared, so it has a potential log lambda divergences. Okay. And for instance, if you compute the leading divergence of this diagram using a sharp ultraviolet cutoff, you discover that indeed there is a divergence in log lambda times h mu nu. Remember, those are photons. So the photons carry indices, vector indices. The fermions carry Dirac indices. And here you have delta, alpha, beta, mu. Okay? There are no color indices because we are the U1, so there are only one color. Okay. And if you have a divergence like that, this is very bad because you can say, OK, I can cancel it by a counter term, but a counter term will be a lambda squared a mu in the action, which is not gauge invariant. Okay. This term is less dangerous because it's also suppressed, but it's less dangerous. Okay. So this means that, in fact, you have to be very, very careful when doing the calculation. It's not a problem. It's not a signal that the theory is sick. It's not a signal that the radiative correction breaks the gauge invariance of the classical theory. It means that in order to quantize consistently the theory, you must do it using an ultraviolet cutoff, which respects gauge invariance. Or, well, you have other way. You can introduce counter terms which breaks gauge invariance, but ensure that each step you get a renormalized theory, which is still gauge invariant. So there are other ways to deal with that. But the best way to do the calculation is to do calculation with an ultraviolet regulator, which respects gauge invariant. And there are not that many regulators. And for instance, one great progress in the understanding of gauge theory was done when people used what is called the dimensional regularization. And essentially, this was one of the great contributions of Gerhard Toft in the beginning of the 60s. Gerhard Toft didn't invent the idea of dimensional regularization. It has been also proposed in statistical physics, but he was the first to really use it and show its power in quantization of gauge theory. And using dimensional regularization is a bit of a strange idea. It's do the calculation assuming that the dimension of space-time is not 4. Oh, yes. It's also different from 0, but it's different from 4. Okay. So you can do the calculation. All the calculation in perturbation theory can be done assuming the dimension is 4. It's not 4. Yes?
So how did Feynman, Schwinger, Tomonaga do the regularization? Presumably
the
dimensional regularization.
Yes, yes. Well, this has been, I don't know exactly all the, I don't remember the details, but people, first, they did it using a special gauge, and second, they introduced counter terms, ensuring that the final, for them, the important thing was that the final result was gauge invariant. And I must say that this picture of introducing counter terms in the action, so everything becomes, was started, of course, by Feynman and Tomonaga, Schwinger, but the full idea of renormalization, the way I presented it, you know, emerged slowly, and I'm not sure they did this calculation exactly the way I presented it myself. Yes?
Why do we care only about the quadratic term, but it's like contour term is non-gauge invariant? And why, for example, don't we apply the same argument to the linear now?
Pardon?
Is there something special about the quadratic in lambda term that we like cannot make the contour term gauge invariant?
Yeah, it is the first emergence of a contour term which is not gauge invariant if you do the calculation. After that, you will have divergence in logarithm of lambda, which are also, if you compute naively, things not gauge invariant. But you see that this problem pops out clearly here.
So it's like that the contour term is not gauge invariant, it's just a result of calculations?
No, it means that if you start from a theory which is gauge invariant, but you use an ultraviolet cutoff which is not gauge invariant, it means that the quantum regularized theory is not gauge invariant. So it's not surprising that you get, when you compute the radiative correction, contribution which are not gauge invariant. It's just that. So you must really use an ultraviolet cutoff which respects gauge invariance. And in that case, those terms disappear. They are not there. Okay. So you see, well, it will become clear later. So the idea, if you use dimensional regularization, it means that you do the calculation in a dimension of space-time which is different from 4. And then, basically, each time that you had a log lambda in a calculation in an ordinary 5, for instance, a 5-4 theory, in fact, you have no ultraviolet cutoff. You just
construct, start from a continuum field theory but compute things in different from four dimensions. And you discover that in general, the calculation makes sense if the dimension is less than four. And therefore, each time you have a log lambda in a calculation done with sharp ultraviolet cutoff, you encounter a pole in 1 over d minus 4 in the dimensions. So the infinity reappears in dimension 4, but in the form of the pole in the dimension. So that in this dimensional regularization scheme, what you try to do, instead of subtracting, introducing counter terms in the theory to subtract the lambda squared and the log lambda squared term, you introduce counter terms in order to subtract the poles. But otherwise, it's exactly the same thing. Instead of chasing the log of lambda, you chase the 1 over d minus 4. Okay? And if you use this dimensional regularization, you discover, for instance, that this term is not present, but you still have log lambda terms, but this term is also not present for another reason. And at the end, you found that this diagram that I will redraw once more. So usually, or in fact, you write that d equal 4 minus epsilon. So this is epsilon will be what we are doing. And one shows that, for instance, this diagram, well, let me first write the photon propagator. Oh, no, let us, yeah. The photon propagator carries an index mu and u. And if the photon has a 4 momentum p, is the four momentum of a photon, you do the calculation, you find at the end that there is indeed a pole over 1 over epsilon. For dimensional reason, the residue of the pole must be a function of the momenta. You do the calculation, and you found that this is h mu nu p squared minus p mu p nu. Okay, so the divergence is proportional to this a term like that. And then you have some number. Let me call it d. It's a combination of 1 over 2 pi squared. It's some number. Okay. So this term is nice because it is gauge invariant. It is precisely the projector that I discussed here today. It projects on the transverse state. You see that if you have a polarization of the photon, which is longitudinal, which is proportional to p, this gives 0. So it's OK. It means that the radiative correction do not create longitudinal states. Good. OK. Now, let us look at the randomization for the photon. Then you also have a pole of order 1 over epsilon. It has to be linear in P. It has a dimension of the inverse of a length, this propagator. Oh, I am considering the irreducible part. I'm considering really the divergence of this diagram and on this part of the diagram. And then you find that you have two contributions. You have a contribution which is proportional to the four momenta of the electron. So you have a P mu. And you have a contribution which is proportional to the mass of the electron. And well, here there is a new contribution. Let me call it B. And here you find that, remember, you find the gamma mu here. And another coefficient, which is A. Okay. So that's nice because this is also relativistic invariant. It shows that this is Lorentz invariant. So your regularization do not break the Lorentz invariance. And finally, let us see what is this diagram.
Well, this is more complicated to compute, but remember. And then you found that these diagrams behave, there is a pole or 1 over epsilon. And there is a coefficient C, a number. And you have, as you expect, a gamma mu alpha beta, if you want. This is, of course, alpha beta. So that's fine because it's also Lorentz invariant. Okay. So it is a nice feature of dimensional regularization. It is gauge and Lorentz invariant. Okay. But now, the question is, can we recast those divergences in counter terms which are present in the Lagrangian here? So this is the original Lagrangian. Can we recast these terms? Okay, these terms, you could expect that you could recast them in a renormalization of the coefficient in front of the f mu nu term, you see? These terms, you expect that you can recast it into a renormalization of this term, d slash, and of this term, m. And this divergence, you expect that you can recast them into a term like in front of the psi bar a psi, okay? But this will be gauge invariant if you still have, after renormalization, the covariant derivative. So this means that the coefficient of renormalization of the d slash and the coefficient of the renormalization of the a slash must be the same. Otherwise, your renormalization procedure breaks gauge invariance. And this is indeed the case. When you do the calculation, you can check that the coefficient here, A, is equal to the coefficient C. And this comes from the symmetries of the theory which comes from the symmetry of the theory. In fact, if you compute, you indeed found that A equals C, you can show why it is true. It comes from the symmetries of the original symmetry, from some identities which are the analog of the neuter, the fact that there is a conserved current for the gauge invariance. Yes?
Can you tell something about this scheme respects gauge and Lorentz invariance? For instance, I don't understand what mu means
It's simply that. In this calculation, you made calculation and so you have mu's coming from p's. So you have p mu's and you have Dirac matrices gamma mu's, okay? And in the calculation, at sometimes everywhere, you have, sometimes you get p mu times p mu. And so when you find the p mu times p mu, say this is p squared, and in the calculation, you also have trace of gamma mu, trace of gamma mu, gamma rho, gamma sigma. And if you open your books on quantum field theory, you will usually have a rule chapter, which is called essentially gamma logy. So it's the rules of calculation of gamma. And you found that you have general formula which says this, for instance, this is 4 times h mu nu. And this is a combination of h mu nu, h nu sigma. And so finally, either you get in the calculation p mu nu, and at some point you have a trace, you found h mu mu, which is a trace of the metric tensor. Okay. In 4 dimensions, this is 4. So you just take it to be D. Assume if I was in 3 dimensions, the trace of the metric
tensor is 3. If I was in two dimension, the trace of the metric tensor would be 2. So if I assume that I'm in D dimension, I just state that this is D. Okay?
So I guess, I mean, we can follow the algebra and
yes.
And see what's happening, that it's working out. But is there by any chance any geometric interpretation to analytically continue to fractional dimensions?
Not really, in fact. It's a very, very nice perturbative way, but you cannot really define a functional integral, define properly what is a functional integral in D dimension. So it's a nice scheme for perturbation theory, but it doesn't have a direct interpretation in terms of functional integral. Okay, but it works for what we want. Okay, so then we get A equals C, which implies that gauge invariance is respected. Okay, and this means, for instance, that the factor A here corresponds to a renormalization of the Fermi field. This means that instead of a Fermi field, you have to state that you have to replace the Fermi field by a factor z times psi, or z one half the normalization. Okay, so it means that you have to change the normalization of the field. So you have the factor A. The factor B means you have the renormalization of the mass of the electron. We have seen that the mass of the 5-4 theory, the mass of the scalar boson is renormalized. The mass of the electron is also renormalized. And the factor D, in fact, renormalizes the factor which is here. So it corresponds to a renormalization of the charge E, of the coupling constant, of the number which measures the strength of the interaction between the gauge field, here a photon, and the matter field, here an electron and a positron. Okay? So I do not have time to do any calculation, but the final result is that E is renormalized, and therefore, if you define the fine structure constant as E squared over H bar C, as everybody wants, it's renormalized, so it has a beta function, and the beta function for the fine structure constant is found to be 2 over 3 half alpha squared. So this is the result of the calculation of QED. And you can find it in any textbook. Okay. So this is a beta function. And remember, the beta function tells you how the effective coupling, the effective charge, gets renormalized as a function of the scale at which you are measuring the scale of the. And here, this means that if the beta function is positive, so the coefficient here is positive, the beta function is a function which is like that. Okay? Remember that basically, if you have an alpha effective which depends on the energy, the beta function is defined by how, as a function of the logarithm of the energy, how this varies. So if it is positive, it means that the coupling constant increases with the energy and decreases at low energy. So this is large E. So this is a screening effect, in fact. It shows that if you are looking at the charge
So, and you measure the charge, for instance, by having an electron, a positron, and measuring the strength of the interaction between. And it means that, you know, it's defined by the Coulomb force. So you have an E squared over R potential. R is the distance, but in fact, what renormalization tells you is that you should have, at high energy, an E squared of R, if you want, of 1 over R, or R0 over R, if R is much, much smaller than R0, which is of order of 1 over the mass of the electron. Pardon? This is a potential. Potential, V0. Okay. And so this means that if you have two charges which are very, very close, they are attracted more strongly than if they are at long distances. You have to go to very, very short distance to see this effect, but it should be there. And it's a screening effect because it means that on the opposite, you know, if you have a charge, if you have two charges at short distance, they are strongly attracted, and when they come apart, they are weakly attracted. So there is a screening of the force by some quantum effect. It's a screening effect. Okay. And in fact, in the quantum theory, this effect is quite understood. It's quite well understood. We have a screening effect by the virtual pairs E plus E minus in the quantum vacuum. Because remember, the ground state of a field is not a classical ground state when you have nothing. You have quantum fluctuations, which creates an annealing. Well, you can view that as you have a pairs of virtual particles which comes and disappears at any time and at any point of space. And if you have, for instance, an electron, which is, or let us say a positron, E minus. You have somewhere an electron. In classical theory, it sits in the vacuum, etc. But in the quantum vacuum, you have pairs of virtual particles which appear and disappear. And imagine they appear. So if they appear in the vacuum, they appear, they disappear. But if they appear close to the electron, the E plus is attracted towards the electron, and the E minus is disappears. So in some sense, the virtual pairs are, in a statistical sense, oriented. There are some small electric dipoles, virtual electric dipoles, which are created and annihilated. But on the average, they are oriented towards the electron. And so they create a screening. So you have a screening effect by the electric dipoles corresponding to the virtual pairs of E plus and of minus in the vacuum. Okay, so it's a... So now, what about non-abelian HCO? Then the study of renormalization is much more complicated because there are much more diagrams. So I won't repeat the diagrams, but I think I've never drawn the one-loop diagrams. So you see, if you think about what's happening just for a pure gauge theory, remember, we have such diagrams like that. We have diagrams like that. And we have diagrams like that for the propagator of the gauge field. Those are the ghosts. And you have virtual pairs of gauge vector. If you are interested in what's happening for the three vertex,
you have this. You have that. This is like that. Okay. You have, of course, and you have like that. And if you are interested in what are the radiative correction to the four vertex, four gauge field vertex, you have this diagram. You have a diagram like that. You have diagrams like that. Don't forget our friends, the Gauss. And I think that's it, but I might have forgotten some diagrams. But you already have many, many diagrams. It's just for a pure gauge field. And of course, imagine that you have a lot of spin and color indices carried by those diagrams. So if you just want to make the list of them, it fits a few pages. Okay? But you can do the calculation. You can check that in any case, you have poles in epsilon or logarithm of the same kind. Yes?
So by pure gauge, you mean, pure gauge theory, you mean that there are no fermions, right?
No, no fermions. If you have fermions, well, if you have fermions, in addition, you basically have those diagrams. Not much change, but still happen. Okay? And so the result is that there is a renormalization. Non-abelian gauge theory are renormalizable also. Okay? So this was the breakthrough of the beginning of the 60s, of the 70s, where people understood that gauge, non-abelian gauge theory could be renormalized as QED. And if you compute, so remember, in gauge theory, you have a coupling which is g square. And let us define g square to be the analog, the alpha, the analog of the fine structure constant for the electrodynamics. But here, this is the charge of the gauge boson. Remember. This is the charge of the gauge boson. So the gauge boson are charged. So this is not the charge of the matter field, which will be related to that, but G will be the charge, G equals the charge of the gauge boson. Okay? The unit of charge, because they carry several charges labeled by the gauge, but it's simply the unit of charge of the gauge boson. Okay? And then, well, the famous results, which was first obtained by Toft, is that you have a factor of alpha squared with a 4 pi squared. So if there is an alpha squared like for the beta function, which means that there is a renormalization at one loop. But then you have a coefficient, and this coefficient, so now let me consider that I have a un or sun gauge group, and that I have NF fermions, Dirac fermions, in the fundamental representation of the gauge group G. And in that case, the famous result is that you get a factor which is 11 over 3 n squared minus 1 over 2n minus, so now you have a contribution of the fermion field, and you have a minus sign. So if you have pure gauge field, with no fermions, n squared minus 1 is positive. So if nf is not too large, 0 or small,
For a non-abelian gauge theory with n larger than 1, because SU1 is just the identity, no, you have no gauge interactions, and you get indeed 0. You have a beta function like that. Beta as a function of alpha is negative, which means that the effective coupling constant as a function of the energy goes to 0 for large energies, while it becomes large at small energies. So, non-abelian gauge theories have a fundamental property which is very different from the Maxwell field. It means they are what is called, they have the property of asymptotic freedom. What means asymptotic freedom? It means that the effective coupling between the gauge fields vanishes at very high energy. So it's a theory which is weakly coupled at high energy. So perturbation theory is a good tool to study gauge theories at high energy. And when this was discovered, in fact, it was the right time because it was precisely at the right time where there was some experiment, I think at SLAC, where in, I think it was anti-electron collision, experimentalists, people discovered that the interactions became weak, the strong interaction became weak at high energies. And there were, for instance, constituents in the protons and the neutrons which interact weakly at high energies. So.
Are you saying this is also true for SU2?
Pardon?
Are you saying this is also true for SU2?
Yeah, you just take n equal 2 in this formula. This is the formula for general SU1. And in fact, basically, I think that this corresponds to what is called the Casimir invariant C2 for the group G. So in fact, this coefficient here, which means that you can take any Lie group. You can take the exceptional Lie group, G2, G7. And you have the similar result. So it's a result which is in fact valid for any Lie group. Then you have a contribution for N. And of course, this formula gets modified if you have supersymmetry. Theories with supersymmetric partner of the matter fields and of the gauge field. In addition to the gauge field, which are called the gluons, you have the gluino, that kind of thing. So it's a formula which is valid for non-supersymmetric theories. Okay. So, but these properties of asymptotic freedom, of course, in the ultraviolet, so at high energy, means also that at low energy, the theory becomes strongly coupled. And the low energy dynamics of quantum gauge theory is highly non-trivial. And very different from the classical theory, completely different. Already the classical theory of gauge theory is something complicated because it's a non-linear theory. The Hamiltonian now is the action is non-linear. It means that the Lagrangian is non-linear. You have non-linear couplings between the gauge field. So already just the question of studying the classical solution of the equation of motion of a non-abelian gauge theory is something which is very, very complicated and which I think still keeps occupied mathematicians now. While finding the classical solution of the Maxwell equation is something that, in the absence of charge, is simply plane waves, and if you have charges, well, you can use a potential theory and get that. Okay. So, and in particular, one of the most important features of the low energy dynamics of quantum gauge theory is the properties of confinement.
sure you have heard about confinement. What confinement means? Confinement means that, in fact, one has not been able to observe the elementary field, the elementary particles which are supposed to be at the basis of an unabelian gauge theory. For instance, let us consider the theory, which is the theory of QCD. QCD is a theory of strong interaction, which is based on the SU3 gauge theory. So, yes?
So if I do input fermions, then depending on the family of fermions,
yes,
the sign changes?
Yes. If there are enough families of fermions, then the theory can become non-asymptotic free. But the number of families of fermions is free. Well, in the standard model, the family contains, you have a quark, but you have also the neutrinos associated. But basically, NF is 3. N is, in fact, you have an SU3 times. So QCD is just a theory of strong interaction. But for if you have the electroweak interaction, you have another gauge group with an SU2 cross U1. And so, in fact, this coefficient is larger than this one. But let us go back to the QCD of strong interaction, where it's a theory where the AMU fields are called the gluons. And you have 8 different kinds of gluons. The carry color indices and the dimension of SU3 is 8. So you have 8 different kinds of gluons. You have the quarks, the psi, and the psi bar are the quarks. And nobody in any experiment has been able to observe either an isolated quark or an isolated gluon. And the reason is that it seems, and for most people, they are convinced that in a non-abelian gauge series, the interactions are so strong that there are no charged particles are isolated, or in the vacuum. Or, if you prefer, a more mathematical definition, there are no charged asymptotic states in the theory. States which describe an isolated bunch of particles moving freely in space. This corresponds to the concept of asymptotic states that you have been studying in the QFT1 course in the theory of collisions and the definition of the S-matrix elements. And why is it so? So you have no charged particles, and what one can observe are only neutral particles, only neutral excitation, which will correspond to some kind of complicated bound states of the theory. And for instance, in QED, we know that what we can observe are pairs of quarks. So the quarks are, the gluinos are defined by that, the quarks are given Q, Q bar, and what you can expect that you could observe are just Q, Q bar pairs, which forms basically the different kind of mesons in the theory. You have an SU3 pair. If you have an SU3 group, you can have triplets of particles made out of 3 quarks, which correspond to the various hadrons of the theory. And in QCD, the only stable hadrons are the proton, the neutron, and their antiparticles. But then you have unstable particles. And if you have a pure gauge theory, or a theory with massive enough quarks, you can have gluons gluons bound states. Okay, you can take a bunch of gluons and combine the charge, so that's the neutral, and they are called gluinos. I'm sorry, not gluinos, they are called glue balls. And it seems that in the real world, the glue balls have a mass which is higher than the mass of the mesons and the hadrons, so they are unstable and it's very unclear. There are some experiments claiming that they have been observing from glue balls, but it's not clear. But in a world where there would be no fermions, then the only observable states would be glue balls. And a picture for that is the following. In fact, there are very, very good indications that confinement is true. First, it is an experimental observation, but perhaps if we go and construct a future high energy accelerator, which is not 7 TeV, but I don't know, 30 TeV or 1 PeV, we could observe isolated quarks, or in some very high energy experiment, astrophysical process, I could observe isolated quarks, but people think that it will never be possible. Yes?
So is there like one hears about confinement, deconfinement, phase transition?
Huh? Ah.
Well,
people are discussing confinement, deconfinement, phase transition, but this is a different matter. This is something which is supposed to happen in finite temperature gauge theory. So, for instance, what was happening at the in the very, very early universe. The statement is about confinement is that no charged but isolated particle can exist. In the vacuum. Very important. You see, if you have a state which is not the vacuum but globally everywhere is something which is already a soup of excited states, then you may question about whether the particles are confined or unconfined. The statement of confinement is what's happening in the vacuum. Okay? There are very good indications that confinement is true, but there is no proof of that. No proof. Just strong indications. And therefore, first the mathematicians, which have been able to prove many things about quantum field theory, consider that proving confinement is be one of the big challenges of mathematical physics. And there are a few physicists, a few heretics, which still believe that confinement is not true. So you are allowed to think that and to try to prove that confinement is not true, or to prove that confinement is true. But yes?
Are there numerical evidence for confinement?
Yes. One of the main evidence for confinement comes from lattice calculation, numerical calculations, which are some kind of simulation of gauge field on a lattice. And I'm not sure I wanted to say a few words on that, but there are strong indications coming in particular from lattice gauge. Other calculations like height, what's called high temperature calculations, or other kind of calculation, but I think the best evidence is numerical and comes from lattice calculation. Well, people have given us many, many approximation schemes, variational approximation schemes to study the property of the vacuum, and in most of the cases they point to confinement, but still not a proof. But you have also a picture. There is also some kind of nice picture, which is very heuristic, but the picture of why confinement occurs. And perhaps I can refer to the some of the last course of Nandini Trivedi. I think she discussed in many details the physics of superconductors. And in superconductors, remember, if you have a superconductor, I think I saw on the picture before. If you have a superconductor medium, and if you have some magnetic field applied to superconductor, when you freeze the temperature and your magnetic system becomes, your electronic crystal becomes superconductor, then the magnetic field is expelled from the superconductor. So no magnetic field can exist in a superconductor. Well, you have type 1 and type 2 superconductors, and in type 2, magnetic field can exist under the form of just tiny vortices. And now, imagine that you have a superconductor here. And imagine that I have found magnetic monopoles. You know, the theory of the Dirac theory of, you know, in standard electromagnetism, in fact, you may very well, nothing forbids the existence of magnetic charges for some deep reason associated to quantum electrodynamics and the fact that, in fact, it's a quantized theory. It seems very implausible that there are magnetic monopoles, at least just as elementary particles. But imagine that there are elementary particles, monopoles. So imagine that we have a monopole here and an anti-monopole here. So a monopole with a magnetic charge plus and an anti-monopole with a magnetic charge minus. So in the same way that there is between two electric charges, there are electric field coming. Between two magnetic poles, monopoles, you don't have electric field, but you have a magnetic field. Okay? So this is a B. You have a magnetic field. Now, if this is non-supra, you have magnetic lines between the magnetic monopoles, but they follow exactly, they are given by exactly the same equation. This is a Coulombic field, but for the magnetic field with the magnetic charge. But imagine that now it becomes supra. Then, of course, the magnetic field should be expelled from the superconductor. But here, if you still have your magnetic monopoles and your anti-magnetic monopoles, this is a monopole, the magnetic field can disappear like that. So what you would like to see is just to concentrate, to occupy the less field. So there will be, if it's supra, you will have a flux, a magnetic flux line. You see? And here, the energy, basically, you know what the energy of Cyclone, the potential V of V here, is given by the total energy of the magnetic field. So if the magnetic field or the electric field is scattered, you know, in the whole space and but decrease very slowly, you of course say that the magnetic field behave like 1 over R, the potential, in what is called the Coulomb phase. Coulomb phase. Coulomb means that there is a Coulomb potential between my magnetic monopole and my anti-monopole. Now, if the magnetic flux line is like that, all the magnetic field is concentrated along the line. So it's with some crude argument, but you can show that in this supra field, The potential should be proportional to r, the distance between the points, because you have a magnetic flux lines with some kind of fixed width, which will be given by some magnetic length of the superconductor. But if you take the pair of monopoles apart, the energy will grow like the length of the line. Okay? And so there is a picture that in non-abelian gauge theory, there is something which is called electric magnetic duality, which means that the vacuum of gauge theory is like a supraconductor, but with respect to the electric charge. And now if you have a quark and an antiquark, a crude picture, but which can be justified in some sense and which is justified in numerical simulation, is that this is a quark, so this is a charge, this is an antiquark. The picture of the lines of the electric field of the Gurmit theory follow, in some sense, the same picture. And therefore, that the energy of a pair, the energy as a function of the distance between the pair of quarks and antiquarks, should behave like r times a constant sigma. And so it means that in the vacuum of a gauge theory, two pairs of quarks are bound by a very strong force. It's like a spring, like a spring. Well, you have constant force. No, it's not like like a spring, but some kind of relativistic spring, because the energy is proportional to R and not like R squared. And in fact, these pictures led, in fact, was influenced by the first idea about string theory for strong interaction. Or a relativistic spring is a string, in fact. The energy can be proportional to the square of the distance, because it's not a relativistic invariant for the problem. So, and if you have that, you see that it requires an infinite energy to separate a pair of quarks and an antiquark, as long as you don't create intermediate pairs of quarks and antiquarks. Because in fact, in the real world, in Jet's experiment, for instance, you start by creating a quarks in a collision. You start by creating a pair of quarks and antiquarks, for instance. You send two particles, they create, you have big particles, you create a pair of quarks and antiquarks, and you have the flux line here. But after some time, you may very well have a virtual pair of quarks, antiquarks created in the vacuum, and then they form the bound state here. They form the bound state here. And you have a pair of neutral here mesons, which are created. So. Okay. But, and that's what's happening in high energy collisions. Those processes are called jets, but it's much more complicated because you create baryons, you create also gluons, and the gluons disintegrates and creates all the particles, so it's much more complicated. But, okay. And this constant here, in fact, if you look a little bit at it, it has a dimension, it's called the string tension. And if you think about what it is,
this string tension, let's call it sigma, in a gauge theory should depend on alpha, the coupling constant of your theory. The alpha, which is here, the coupling constant. Coupling constant. Okay? But if you think a little bit and say, okay, this is a string tension, so it has some dimension in energies and lengths and h bar, and alpha is a coupling constant, but alpha depends on the energy. Alpha is renormalized. But this energy, in fact, tells you, this string tension tells you how the energy scales with the distance. So the fact that the energy scales at the distance as the distance itself tells you that this string tension is an object which has a well-defined dimension under a normalization group transformation. And you know how the coupling constant behaves as a function under a normalization group calculation. So you think a little bit, you sit, you write what is the corresponding renormalization group equation for this specific quantity, and I won't give the detail here, but you discover after the end that this can only depend on alpha as mu squared times exponential of minus some constant, which will relate to the coefficient here, the beta function, times alpha, where mu is precisely the renormalization scale. Remember, mu zero of the theory. Remember, in any gauge, in any quantum field theory, when you talk, discuss about what is a coupling constant, you have to specify what is the energy at which you define it. For instance, you define what is the energy of the, what is the coupling constant of QCD by making collision experiments between proton and antiproton at CERN at, I don't know, let's say 1 TeV. From this, you deduce what is the value of the coupling constant of QCD at a scale, energy scale of 1 TeV, which is mu zero. And then, in fact, you discover that the string tension behaves like that. And, okay, so this is just a trivial consequence of renormalization equation. And this is something very important because you see that you have an exponential of minus a constant. The constant will be given by the inverse of this coefficient. Okay? And you see that this is something which is exponentially small. Exponentially small when alpha, the coupling constant, is taken to be small. Because this is a function, when alpha is small, 1 over alpha is very large, minus 1 over alpha is very, very large and negative, so the exponential is very, very small. And this is an example of a function which is non-zero in alpha, but its Taylor expansion around alpha equals 0, any of the term is 0. You see? So this function is basically 0 in perturbation theory at all orders. So no perturbative calculation in QCD will allow you to compute the surface, the string tension, and the strength of the interaction between pairs of quarks and antiquarks. So this is an example among many where you have a highly, what is called a non-perturbative phenomenon. So a very important feature of the dynamics of gauge theories, which cannot be calculated and described using only the tool of perturbation theory. Yes?
Is it obvious from the expression that a string tension is large at small at low energies?
No, it's small. Because
If alpha, oh, you mean the string tension is large?
Well, if we expect confinement, then the string tension should be large at small energies, right?
No, no. The string tension is just a number. It's a constant. The string tension has a dimension of an energy. You see? In fact, because it's an energy divided by the, so if you work things precisely, everything works fast. So the string tension do not depend on the energy. It's a number. It's a characteristic of the series. Simply, if you express it in units of energy, it will scale under the units of energy, but in a trivial way.
So the statement of confinement is already contained in the fact that the energy scales with R.
No, the statement of confinement means basically that in this feature, confinement means that sigma is positive. Okay. If sigma is zero, there is no confinement. If sigma is positive, there is confinement. Okay. That's it. And the point is that sigma, everybody thinks that sigma is positive for a pure gauge series, but you cannot compute this sigma in perturbation theory. You have to rely on non-perturbative methods. So you see, perturbation theory, we spend a lot of time discussing what perturbation theory is because it's a very, very important tool and it gives you a physical idea of what's going on in quantum theory. But perturbation theory is by far not the only tool. And for many, many important questions, you cannot only use perturbation theory or you have to mix perturbation theory with some other idea in physical and mathematical schools. And I wanted to speak a lot of things, but one of the tools which allows to study gauge series in a non-perturbative way is what is called lattice gauge series. And let me just say a few words about that. I have 5 minutes. Okay. So, lattice gauge theory was invented, in fact, by Ken Wilson, always the same Wilson, with some, in fact, there was a contribution by a German physicist called Wegener, which was more a statistical and condensed matter physicist, who had a similar idea on the same times, but for what is called the Z2 gauge series. We have discussed gauge series for Lie groups, but you can also formulate gauge series for discrete groups. In particular, for the Z2 group, it's not very interesting for high energy physics, but it's very interesting for many problems of condensed matter. But Ken Wilson did that, of course, for the SU, etc. Okay, and the idea is, how can we define a discretized version of gauge theory on a lattice, which allows to do first to do calculation with an ultraviolet cutoff, so that we control what's going on at high energy, and we can neglect what's going on at high energy, and for instance, do Wilsonian renormalization group calculation. It's also useful in order to define gauge theory in Euclidean space. In fact, lattice gauge theory are defined in Euclidean space, and then go down. Okay, so the idea is, you know, so the question is that the point is that it's non-trivial to define a gauge theory on a lattice because, remember, the degrees of freedom. The degrees of freedom of a gauge theory are gauge connections, so they depends on this is what's called A. So there are elements in the Lie algebra of a group. This is the group indices. That depends on the position. And there is a degree
of freedom associated to the direction in space. Okay. And Ken Wilson suggested, in fact, to do the following things. Instead of having a lattice where the field lives on the links, consider a theory as a theory where the degrees of freedom lives on the links. So, here is a link. Okay. And to each link, is associated an element dx, which is simply a vector associated to the link. You see? And imagine that you associate the A, so if the link lives in the mu direction, okay, dxl is just epsilon times e mu, where e mu is the unit vector in the mu direction of the lattice. Okay? And so Ken Wilson say, okay, let us imagine that, in fact, there is a group element. There is a group element associated to this link, which is an infinitesimal group element, which is 1 plus I epsilon A mu A times E mu. Yes. TA. Okay?
Do you have to consider only infinitesimal?
Yeah, you consider that G is small to 1 because of the dynamics of the gauge field. So in fact, but in fact, it's just an approximation. Okay. So the idea is, in fact, is to consider that to any link, let us call it L, and I consider an oriented link, I associate a group element G of L belonging to the group. You see? So to each link, I associate L, I associate a G of L.
Doesn't that cut down the space of
Pardon?
Doesn't that cut down the space of group transformations that were
Does it?
It looks like that cuts down the space of group transformations. Hugely.
It makes describe, but you will see it still keeps the feature. Okay, so to a link L, which is defining like that, I associate an element of the group. Of course, to the anti-link like that, which I will call L bar, I will associate a G of L bar, and by definition, I take it to be the inverse of G of L. Okay? And otherwise, that's it. Okay? And then, so I have a gauge, so now a gauge transformation, a gauge configuration is replaced by a data of G of L for all the links on my lattice. So instead of having one field here, one field here, I have one field here, one field here, one field here, one field here, one field here. And you see that by doing that, you have more degrees of freedom, okay, than for a scalar field. And now you try to look for an action which is the version for this version of the field of the F mu term. So what is the analog of trace of F mu nu? And the analog of that is something which is very beautiful. It is given by, consider now that we have a plaquette. I think that's the English name, to plaquette. So you have a square. In the lattice, you have many squares, because in fact, it's a four-dimensional lattice. So you have plaquette here, here, here.
So imagine that you have a plaquette formed of two links, of four links like that, L1, L2, L3, L4. Okay? Then you can define a group element. So this plaquette, let's call it T. You can define a group element associated to the plaquette, which is just G of L1 times G of L2 times G of L3 times G of L4. So you get the successive products of the group element on the plaquette. You see? Take the trace of G of L2. This is basically, well, of course, you are expanding around one, but trace of G of P is essentially the discrete version of trace of F mu nu, because you see that a plaquette is associated to two directions in space, one direction for the first link mu and one direction for mu. So a plaquette is characterized by the position hits and two directions, mu and nu. You see? And if you interchange mu and nu, you just reverse the orientation of the plaquette. If you reverse the orientation of the plaquette, you get the inverse element. Okay? And therefore, if instead of taking as an action over the whole spacetime, you take a sum over all plaquettes of your lattice, trace of G of P, find like that, there is perhaps a minus sign, because the trace is maximum for G, so there is a minus, something like that here. Okay? You define that this to be the lattice version for the plaquette. So we define this is the lattice action for the configuration given by all the leads, the trace variable. You see that an action like that is gauge invariant, in the sense that if to any point x, a point of the lattice, I associate a gauge transformation H of x belonging to the group. So now I make the gauge transformation associated to the point of the lattice, not on the link of the lattice. It's easy to see that if I have a link with a point x and a point y here, if I make the transformation that instead of considering g of the link length, I associate g of the links times h of y minus 1 times h of x, and I define this to be the transform g prime of L, this is precisely a gauge transformation. Okay. And it's easy to see that the trace of the products of the group element on the plaquette is gauge invariant, because you have the product of G, 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 and each time that you have an H, G, H minus 1, but for the next one, I will have the H minus 1, G, H, etc., etc. So everything cancels. Yes?
Why do you have H, Y, the last one?
Because you have to take a plaquette, a link, is characterized as a link sending one point to another point.
Doesn't it make some problems with locality?
Pardon?
Doesn't it make some problems with locality?
No, because it's precisely a local gauge transformation. It depends only on the local properties of the link. So this is the correct definition for gauge transformation on the lattice. See? Yes?
So I think what he's saying is that the H, one argument of H is X, the other argument of H is Y.
Yes.
But they become the same in absolute.
Yeah, if you go to a continuum limit, they become the same. So you can define this properly with an epsilon and then take the limit epsilon goes to zero. And if you take that, you can check that you discover the action. Okay. So So it's just to give you an idea that there is a perfectly well-defined way to define gauge theory on a lattice, but you have to associate the gauge degrees of freedom to the links of the lattice, not to the points on the lattice. And that's simply because the gauge degrees of freedom are vectors, fields, so they depend on the dimension, on the direction of space, and not only the position of space, and therefore they have to be associated to something which contains information about the position in space and the direction in space. So this idea of Ken Wilson proved out to be very, very fruitful because, in fact, starting from that, you can define a functional integral on the lattice for gauge theory, and you can evaluate those functional integrals by numerical simulation because now you consider that you have a finite lattice. You have group variables associated to elements of the group associated to each links, and you have a finite dimensional over a product of Lie groups, and you can evaluate those integrals either by numerical method or try to compute them by analytical method. So this is lattice gauge theory, which are very, very useful tool to study the non-perturbative dynamics of lattice gauge theory. Yes?
So say you want to couple with matter.
Yes?
Like a scalar field, I will put a
derivative. So it's possible. If you have scalar, if you want to couple it to scalar fields,
it will be on the link, on the links, right? The scalar field will be on the points of.
The scalar field will be still be live on.
But what will do with spinor fields? What about spinor fields?
Spinor field is a bit tricky question. It's possible, believe me, it's possible to put fermions on the lattice, but there are some subtleties. Because you have to add spinor's degrees of freedom. So one way to do that is to add Firbines and to define the spinor with respect to Firbine. But there are problems associated to chirality of fermions. There is a problem called fermion doubling, which means that if you think that you are adding one Dirac field on a four-dimensional lattice, usually you are, in fact, adding, I think, 15 or 8 fermions. This problem was also studied and solved by Ken Wilson, so don't worry. But there are subtleties with fermions that I don't really have time. I already have 10 minutes ahead of my time. But it's possible. Believe me, it's possible, but there are subtleties, and those subtleties are still an object of research now. Okay, so thank you. I think I should stop that. There were many other things I'd like to explain to you, but there is no time. So I think you will see them in a future QF3 or QF4 course. And I thank you very much for all of you for your attentions, for your questions, for your enthusiasm. It was really a pleasure to come back one more time. Really, it's a very great experience to come. And I thank all of you for being there and listening at me. Thank you.
So on behalf of Sai, I'd like to thank you and present you with your 2012 signed T-shirt, and also this is a card that the students.
Thank you very much. May I ask you something? I would like to keep a picture of you. So can you stay here still for a few seconds? And I because I realized that from the previous year, I just have some piece of paper with the faces that John gave me. And, thank you very much. So. Yeah, almost perfect. Okay.